This is Jeffrey Sachs, editor of Tradition. In this episode of our podcast, Molly Brofsky and Mark Smilowitz discuss the central thesis of his article, Esther and the Spies, a biblical-based symbolic meaning of walled cities from the time of Joshua, which appeared in Tradition's fall 2024 issue and is now open access at traditiononline.org. Smilowitz explains how, through an analysis of the textual connection between the walled cities in the time of Joshua and those at the time of the Purim story, he's uncovered a message about how the Jewish nation is enjoined to move from fear to courage through their connection to faith during times of crisis. The two discuss the importance of reading halachic and traditional texts with an eye towards understanding their deeper philosophical, theological, and ethical messages within those texts, and also consider the significance of the essay's message regarding faith and meaning, how we see this experience reflected in our own time, and how it can serve as a source of support during the great challenges facing us today. Molly Brofsky, a member of Tradition's editorial board, is a senior faculty member at Michlelet Mevaseret Yerushalayim and a social worker in private practice. Mark Smilowitz, a veteran educator in Israel and the United States, recently completed a doctorate on the thought of Rabbi Soloveitchik at the Hebrew University. With Purim and its walled cities around the corner, we thought it would be instructive to share their conversation about these themes.
Welcome to this Tradition podcast. I'm extremely honored and appreciative of the opportunity to speak with Mark Smilowitz, who has written an article for Tradition on Esther and the Spies, a biblical-based symbolic meaning of walled cities from the time of Joshua. We're going to start with asking Mark to clarify the essential theme of his article, but I just want to open by saying that the reason why I'm so much looking forward to this conversation is because I think that the theme that Mark brought out here is extremely timely for the experience that we're living through here in Israel and extremely inspiring. I know that I found it personally inspiring. I've heard from others that it's personally inspiring. And while I always want to give the caveat that I want to make room for everybody's experience, and so I don't, you know, I want to make space for different people experience things differently and what we're going through differently. I do hope that this conversation will be a source of another strand to hold on to help us bring some, perhaps the word is meaning, because that's what we're going to be talking about, meaning, faith, that can help us, some of us perhaps, again, I always want to be keep it very sort of humble, but help some of us in this difficult times. So Mark, again, it's a pleasure. And, you know, please share with us the thesis of this article.
Thank you so much, Molly. It's really great to be here with you. And thank Tradition for hosting this discussion. So this article works and functions on a number of different levels, and you're definitely right. There is a message here about emuna that I think is very relevant to today's time, specifically today, in this year, past the year and a half or so. But essentially, it's an article about Purim, and so it's also quite timely. But it's also more than that. Essentially, I was bothered by a question for many, many years. I mean, ever since I was a kid, and I heard this halacha that I found puzzling. And that was the question of, the halacha in question is that we all know that Purim is celebrated on the 14th of Adar, but not by everybody. Jerusalem celebrates Purim on the 15th of Adar. And the halacha is that any walled city, but specifically a city that had walls at a specific time, namely at the time of Yehoshua, any city that had a wall at the time of Yehoshua, even if it doesn't have one now, or even if it has one now, so even if it doesn't have one now, it celebrates on the 15th. And a city that might have a wall now, but did not have one in the time of Yehoshua, would not celebrate on the 15th. And I always found it strange, why did Chazal pick the times of Yehoshua? Yehoshua is, he's an interesting character. He often plays second fiddle to Moshe Rabbeinu. Why his time is the definitive time? So there are a number of answers suggested by various Mefortchim, which I don't want to get into now. I hope people read the article, which is on the tradition website. But none of the answers had satisfied me. And I had a thought when I was going over Parshas Devarim that led me to a certain direction of thinking, which I think bore good fruit. So the what I was reading in Devarim was Moshe Rabbeinu in Perek Gimel is describing how the Jews, after 40 years in the desert, they succeeded in defeating a number of kings of and cities and conquering these cities. And when Moshe describes these cities, he makes a point of saying that you conquered some walled cities and some unwalled cities. And he uses the word parazi for describing unwalled cities. And I'm not going to go over every source. You can look at it again in the article to see where the pasuk is, but I'm just going to give broad strokes. That's an unusual word, parazi, for an unwalled city. You don't really find it so much, but you do find it in Sefer, in Parsha Devarim, and in Megillat Esther. And I started thinking about the meaning of that term, and it's in its context in the story of Moshe Rabbeinu. And I realized that there's actually a very deep meaning in that story, which is not obvious because I think that most people, when they read the story in Devarim, they feel like they're being told all sorts of battle statistics that may be interested to a statistician. But you know, Moshe talks about how many cities we conquered, how many different kings that they conquered. He even talks about the king of Og, Melech HaBashan, and the size of his bed and how big a giant he was. And these are all sorts of details that one wonders, why are they even important? They were told more or less at the end of Sefer B'Midbar, and we know the Torah doesn't like to repeat itself. And so I remembered I had heard shiurim from Rav Mordechai Sabato when I was in Yeshivat Har Etzion, and he was giving shiurim on Dvarim, and I used what I learned from him, and what I'm going to say now is maybe slightly adapted to focus on the Emuna message, but it basically comes from his approach. I believe that Moshe Rabbeinu was giving a fundamental lesson in emuna, in faith.
Can I just interrupt you for 1 second?
Of
Sorry.
Course.
Just because before you move on to the faith message, I want to just really, and we're going to talk about this, but I really want to highlight that what you just said, really, I think a lot of people, certainly people who study Tanakh seriously, can relate. Like, I've had the same questions. I'm sure many other people have too. Like, so random, like why the cities of Yehoshua ben Nun, like Ma HaKesher, what is the connection to Purim? That question, I think, bothers a lot of people. It just seems like such a technical, you know, this pasuk, that pasuk, what's that about? And a second issue is the issue of like when Moshe Rabbeinu tells these stories and we read them, we're reading these stories about conquering and Og and his bed, and we have a sense that Moshe's conveying something important, but we don't know what it is. It's like we feel like this. There's this latent meaning underneath, you know. And we'll get to this, but like we assume there's. Well, you and I assume we'll talk about this, that there's a latent meaning under Chazal's connection. But also, when you read Tanakh, we assume that there's definitely meaning under Moshe's message to the people, and we're completely clueless to what it is. And I just wanted to set that up because what you're about to say, I think, answers questions that you're not the only one who's been asking. I think anyone who's a serious studier who takes Chazal's messages seriously and seriously studying Tanakh has asked those questions. So I just want to kind of set that up before you give us the answer, you know, because I really feel that it feels like you're answering real questions. You're not just kind of giving us a nice fort. You're actually answering real questions that anybody serious is sort of asks themselves. So sorry for the interruption. But
that's a good
ahead.
No, it's a good
yeah.
Point. When Rav Sabato was teaching this section, he uncovered the meaning simply by broadening the canvas and telling us, look at the context in which these psukim and Devarim arise. The story that Moshe tells begins at the beginning of Devarim with his telling that over the story of the spies 38 years or 40 or so years earlier. when the Jews failed and were terribly punished because they refused to enter the land and to fight the Canaanim. And there too, he mentions, Moshe Rabbeinu mentions cities. He doesn't mention unwalled cities, but he does mention walled cities. And he points out that the Jews at the earlier generation, the generation that left Egypt, they were afraid to listen to God's command to fight for the land of Canaan, and they were afraid. One of the things they were afraid of was these walled cities, and Moshe Rabbeinu ascribes the basically calls this a failure in emuna. He even says about the varzei inchem ma'aminim b'Hashem. And what Moshe Rabbeinu is doing in two prakim later, Perek Yimel, when he's recounting how we did destroy these cities in the second generation, not the generation that left Egypt, but the generation that entered the land, they succeeded where the earlier generation had failed. And Moshe Rabbeinu points out, you conquered walled cities and unwalled cities. The emphasis there being on the walled cities. Even the cities that had scared you the most, you were successful with. And you even conquered giants who they were scared to conquer in the earlier generation. And Moshe Rabbeinu here is teaching the Jews that they should not necessarily give themselves a pat on the back, but they should understand that they have grown and they learned the lesson to trust in God. When God says that he'll be beside you, go fight to trust in God, to not give in to fear. And I want to, we'll talk more about, there's a lot to say about this message of Emunah, but I do believe that Chazal saw that this message was connected to the story of Purim. And in fact, if you look in the Gemara, the source for the rule that cities that had a wall at the time of Yehoshua, that they celebrate Purim on the 15th. The source for that is actually from this pasuk in Perek Gimel of Devarim, where Moshe mentioned the unwalled cities of the Perazi. It's a gzeira shava, a technical rule of learning from one halacha, from one pasuk to in one context to another context, because the same word appears in both contexts. So the thing that I realized from Parsha Devarim is that we have here two generations. One failed the test of Emunah, one succeeded in the test of Emunah. And the first generation, we would call the generation of Moshe Rabbeinu. They're the ones that Moshe led out of Mitzrayim. The second generation really is the generation of Yehoshua. I mean, Moshe Rabbeinu certainly led them for a while, but their real coming onto the stage and of Jewish history is in Sefer Yehoshua when they conquer the land. Obviously, there are other stories of them in Sefer Bemidbar and Dvarim, but the bulk of their activities is conquering the land with Yehoshua. And we see that in the story of Yehoshua, the walls that the Jews had been afraid of. I could just mention a pasuk or two. Moshe, there's some memorable pasukim where Moshe says, you looked at these walls, Arim Bitzurot Ad HaShemayim. I'm not quoting it exactly right, but yeah, I'll just here. Yes. Yeah, Arim Gedolot Uvitzorot Bashamayim. You were scared of these fortified walls. In the time of Yehoshua, the walls come crumbling down. We know the story with Jericho. They physically come crumbling down, but that physical falling down is actually symbolic as well. It's symbolic of the fact that this new generation has arrived. Hashem is saying the walls that had caused you fear in the past, you see they are not to be feared. That God will accompany us, and the things we are afraid of, he can remove those obstacles. So what I realized was that there's actually a very similar story in Megillat Esther. And the two stories are very connected. That's why I called the article Esther and the Spies. Esther was tasked by Mordechai to go approach Ahasuerus and plead on behalf of the Jewish people, to save the Jewish people. And Esther was scared to do so. She had a fear that she was going to be killed. She was going to be killed because Ahasuerus had a rule that no one is allowed to approach the king unless he invites them first. I think he was kind of paranoid, and that's why he had that rule, and he had good reason to be, as we know from Big Tan Bateresh.
And in fact,
But
he can't sleep that night. He's wondering who's plotting against him. Yeah.
for sure, for sure. So to approach the king was a life-threatening activity. And Esther, at that moment, if we freeze that moment in time when Esther initially refuses, her situation is very similar to the Jews of the first generation, the spies,
Same thing.
who were afraid for their lives and did not want to do what needed to be done because they were scared they're going to be killed. So Mordechai steps in here and he gives Esther a pep talk. It's a well-known pep talk where the essential idea is, this is your time. Maybe this is the reason that God made you queen. And if you don't step in to save the Jews now, somebody else will save the Jews and you may end up being lost. And what Mordechai is saying here is, I mean, how did he know someone else was going to step in? How does he know the future? Because we have a certain promise from HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he will protect the Jewish people. We don't know how that protection will manifest itself. We don't know if every endeavor is going to be successful. We certainly know that a lot of them are not. But we know the general trajectory is that the Jewish people is an Am HaNetzach and HaKadosh Baruch Hu will eventually deliver us. Mordechai was telling Esther, you need to understand. Now, Mordechai is interesting. He did not have the same kind of guarantee as the Jews in the desert. When Yehoshua and Kalev tried to bring the generation of the spies back to Emunah, they were relying on a promise God gave that he'll save the Jews, he'll protect them right there and then in that particular battle. Mordechai did not necessarily have such a nevuah that he knew that Esther was going to be successful in this particular activity, but he did know the general idea that that God protects the Jewish people and therefore eventually we're going to be saved. This seems to be the way to do it, so go ahead. And Esther has a turnaround. She does not fall into the trap that the spies fell in. She listens to the pep talk, and in one moment of her life, she changed from the failure of Emunah to the success of Emunah. What took 30 something years for the Jews in the Midbar to do, Esther in that one moment realized, I'm going to rely on God, and we know the rest of the story. She saves the Jewish people. So this idea of a dynamic faith, which begins with fear, but through faith, I conquer my fear and I can do and accomplish extraordinary things I didn't think I could do, is the theme in both stories on Emunah that develops from fear to courage, from lack of Emunah, I should say, due to fear to Emunah through courage or courage through Emunah. It's hard to know which one comes
Right.
first. They could come simultaneously. It doesn't matter so much, but they come together. And Chazal wanted to highlight that in the importance of that emunah in the hashgacha of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, they'll see the Jewish people by connecting the story of Esther to that story, to that pasuk in Devarim, and to the development of the Jews' emunah in the Midbar. And I believe that this halacha that Chazal said, let's set aside a special day for a certain kind of city to celebrate. We know that in the Megillah, the reason that's given is because Shushan actually fought an extra day that and the other cities did not they finished their fighting on the 14th. Shushan finished on the 15th, or I should say they celebrated on the 15th after finishing. And we know that's why there's a different day for walled cities. But the reason what I'm suggesting is the reason Chazal picked the time of Yehoshua is because the generation, the walls in the time of Yehoshua held a certain symbolism that the walled cities in the times of Moshe Rabbeinu did not hold. Walled cities in the times of Moshe Rabbeinu were a symbol of fear. They were a symbol of terror. Whereas in the time of of Yehoshua, the walled cities became a symbol of fear that's been conquered. They became a symbol of Emunah, trust, and bitachon, trust that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will save the Jewish people. And that symbolism drives the story of the Megillah, just like it does that story there. And that is the basic idea of the article.
It's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. I want to add one more, just another piece, which I think you've said, but I want to highlight it because I think there are two things about it that I find very powerful. Also, just in terms of like when I teach Megillat Esther, but you know. Okay, let me say, let me, I don't know which direction to go. Let me start like this. I think one of the things you're also saying, you can tell me if you disagree, but I think you're also saying when you're talking about the Jews in the time of the Miraglin and the Jews in the time of Yehoshua, you're also describing a different generation in terms of the generation that left Egypt and the generation that's coming into Eretz Yisrael, and that the generation that's entering the land that has this national consciousness that maybe it took 40 years to develop and maybe we needed a second generation to get there. I think that there's a link, and again, we can talk about this when we get there, later in the conversation. But I think that there's a link between that national consciousness that they have as they enter Eretz Yisrael and their ability to hear this message, from Moshe when he says it to them, to hear it again when Yehoshua, tells them Rak Chazak VeEmatz, and they say back, they say it to him. They're like, we're good. You be chazak be'amatz. We're with you, right? That there's a connection between feeling like you're part of a national destiny and that faith that we can do this. As you said, no guarantee that everything's going to be smooth and that any individual situation is going to work out exactly the way we want. But we're part of a divine plan. We're part of a national plan. I also think, and this is my addition and. I won't develop the entire idea just for time, but I happen to think that Esther's transformation is the same. I think Mordechai, Al Tadabi ben Avshech Lihimaleit Beit HaMelech, Shar HaMelech, Beit HaNashim, whatever the phrase is there. Don't think that you can escape. Ki Mecharei Shecharishi Adu Veido Vich Tovedu, Refach HaHatzalah Yamod LeYudim B'Makom Acher. I'm not saying it in order, but the points more that Mordechai is making to Esther is, Esther until this point has been very passive, has been very Shushan-like, right? Shushan is a place where women are very passive. They're very quiet. They're taken. They have no voice. Think about Vashti. Think about the, right? And that's who Esther's been. And Mordechai sort of says, I want you to switch your perspective. I'm giving you now a Jewish perspective, a national destiny perspective. Ano beit avich tovedu, like whether that means you'll die or it means you'll just disappear into the midst of history because you're part of, the Persian Empire. It doesn't matter. What he's saying is if you identify with Persia, you're going to disappear with Persia. But if you decide to identify with the Jewish people, if this is that God put you here to do this, right? He's basically saying two things. I believe God will save us, as you say, quite incredible, because he doesn't have a nevuah, but he definitely, from the beginning, he's Ish Yehudi, who knows who he is. He has his lineage. He knows he belongs in Yerushalayim, right? He knows he's in Gola, from whatever generation. He has that sense of nationality, of national destiny, and that's what he's saying to her. And Esther's greatness is that she hears it and that she chooses to affiliate with the nation, and that comes together with that ability to move from fear to courage that you're discussing.
There's no question.
It's very, very, very powerful, the Megillah.
We all have two identities. We have our personal identity and we have identity with a people, and our davening, or our, we pray in plural. We don't just pray for our own needs, but we include our needs within the general needs of the Jewish people. We talk about hashgacha, God's providence. We talk about two kinds. We talk about hashgacha pratit and hashgacha klali. There's a lot of talk about hashgacha prati, but there should be a lot of talk also about hashgacha klali. And when you identify with the Jewish people, you are part of something bigger than yourself. But it's both bigger than yourself and part of yourself. It's something inside you that's bigger than yourself.
It's a little paradoxical. It makes you be a piece of something greater, but you still have your individuality, but you're a piece of something greater. So I just want to say one more thing, and then I want to move into the next point, which is the idea of the dynamism here, the idea that it's possible to shift, right? I think that sometimes we get very stuck in like, I'm feeling this way and I'm stuck in this way and there's no movement. And there are some people who are extremely strong and they're always strong, right? And to me, that's like the Mordechai model, the Kalev and Yehoshua model. And then there are the rest of us, the most of us. And I think that's the Esther model, where it's okay that we start in fear, and it's okay if we start in dejection or worry. But the message you're giving is that that's completely not only acceptable, but like Esther's the heroine of the story. As human beings, the ability to change and to grow and to learn and to shift is that's part of our human experience, and it's part of our faith experience. And I think that's really powerful as well. Okay, so in the interest of time, I want to move us on to another topic that I think is important to you, and I think it's important to me as well, which is another point that I think you want to bring out in this article is, as we've mentioned, is that Chazal, you know, and all Tanakh, right? But specifically here, Chazal, when they're making their Gezeirah Shava and they're making their rules, there can be a pitfall people can fall into, which is to read the halacha, sometimes even the Tanakh, extremely technically, extremely sort of like mathematically almost, like it's a bunch of rules. And I think for you, I think one of the points you're trying to make is that if you read that way, you're missing the depth of the messaging that Torah, let's just use that broad word, but that will include Tanakh, that will include Machshava, that will include Halacha, that will include Gemara, that there's always depth there, and that when we forget to do that, we're going to be tragically missing the messages that are meant to be imparted to us through these works of wisdom. So I'm just, you know, sort of opening that up to you to sort of remark on a little bit.
Well, yes, I agree. I think that if you ask someone, what sources would you turn to study Jewish philosophy? You know, the first place they might turn to is the professional books on Jewish philosophy, the medieval Jewish philosophers. They may look at Agadata, how does one translate Agadata? People know what Agadata is. They may look at
the non
stories and legends.
Stories and legends, perfect.
Or they may look in the Tanakh. So what I'm suggesting in this article is a very unlikely source, which is to look at the details of halacha and that halachic discourse. And I didn't make this up. I mean, I got this. I noticed this as a theme in Rav Soloveitchik's writings and talks. I actually wrote a doctoral dissertation on Rav Soloveitchik that touches on this to a large degree. That the details of halacha, if studied carefully, can be revealed to be sources of deep human meaning, emotional values oriented ideas. So you can open, people don't generally do this, open up a Mishnah Brura, a Shulchan Aruch, and say, I want to study Jewish philosophy from it. It's not an easy thing to do. I don't think I could have done it if I didn't have the background, as I mentioned, from Rav Sabatosh here, of having studied Parshanut HaMikra, to study Tanakh seriously, which helped develop my thoughts in certain directions. But I think it's very important that we avoid a pitfall of looking at halacha, and as Orthodox Jews, we're very meticulous about halacha to minute details. And for an outsider who's not familiar with Orthodox Judaism, it can seem very strange. Why are you so picayune? Why does God care about such minute details? This is a common complaint, I guess, people have about Orthodox Judaism. To me, the details of halacha, if studied within a certain context, are a kind of poetry. But you have to be open to it, and you have to look for it. And one of the things that I was very happy to be able to, I hope I was able to do in this article, was to take a halacha that seemed very technical. Chazal had to pick a time for when the cities had walls. They picked Yehoshua, and they picked it because of it connecting this pasuk to that pasuk. And to say, well, you know, maybe there is actually emotion and meaningfulness behind that decision or accompanying that decision. I'm not necessarily saying that Chazal made their decisions through their emotions. What I am
no,
saying
no, but what you're saying is that this pitfall that people often find, halacha is dry, halacha is rote. Right? I guess, I mean, if you're going back to Soloveitchik, it's the entire argument of halachic man is do not think that the halachic man is devoid of emotion, spirituality. It's most important, I would say, ethics, you know, but like, if you're just going to live your Torah life on that technical level, so it's like, sort of iman afshach. If you live it on that technical level, you're missing a lot. And then there are people who can't handle it. They just find it so not meaningful. And so they tend to minimize it or reject it. And so what you're saying is so important because I think, A, it's the truth, but it's also, it's such a richer way to live Torah and halacha. Like, I just feel like it's so important for people to understand this idea, just to even know that it exists so that they have access to that possibility of plugging in, not just to the rote, but to knowing that they're supposed to be digging deeper and to be mining the wisdom here and the philosophy, and to go back to that word, meaning, that you're mentioning. Yeah, 100%.
For sure. And I can make this a little more personal, because something you can relate to, because when I was sitting yeshiva for my father's Ikron Libratha, I was presented with a number of books that taught me the halachas of Avelut, the halachas of mourning, and a number of the books had the rules as a list. This is the halacha in this situation, the halacha in this situation. And you know, because I had a certain kind of training, I'm able to look at that list and see a story and see a meaning behind it. But most people, I don't think, are able to do that. And I thought there should be a book out there that treats the halacha as a kind of story with meaningfulness. And as you know, a discussion that I had with your husband, with Rabbi David Brodsky, about this topic ended up leading to his book, Hilchot Aveilut.
Yes. So the beautiful plug for the book that you were instrumental in giving forth to the world, Baruch Hashem, was a wonderful thing. Yeah,
but it's based on the same idea that the halacha should breathe life into the halacha and share with people the living emotion that's embedded in and embodied by a detailed halachic observance.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're also right that I think Soloveitchik believed it very deeply. I think again, there's this interesting conversation about Tamei HaMitzvot at the end of Uvikashtem, where, you know, he sort of talks about how it is that you attribute meaning to halacha, which I think is a different conversation, but I think should be mentioned as well. But I still think, like, if you read the corpus of Soloveitchik, I think his whole message is you're supposed to look at the halachic system as this blueprint that God is giving us. You know, we partner with him in figuring out what he's trying to tell us. But we're supposed to be creating a world of meaning, a world of ethics, an ethical moral code. And that's why we're keeping halacha at the end of the day. I also found one quote that I want to read from Rav Amital. Quotes from an article called Torah Study in the Modern World. And he says exactly what you're saying. So that's why I wanted to read it. So he mentions the pasuk Shiviti Hashem Lenagdi Tamid, right? You're supposed to always think about God. He says, what does that mean? He says, I don't know if I can think about God every single second. But then he says, often it is a good idea to take a break and think about the greatness of Torah, its noble messages, the mighty revolution which it has wrought in the world, right? And then he says, listen, sometimes, you know, some things are easier to see than others. You know, the ox which gores a cow might be a little more complicated than other topics. Nevertheless, he discusses, a scientist that studies an atom, right? He says, inducts from his small sphere something of the wisdom that underlines the entire universe. He need not necessarily know much in other areas, but knowing as he does the wisdom concealed in a small detail in front of him, he learns to appreciate that this tiny thing is part of the encompassing entity that is the world. The same applies in the area of Torah study. The understanding of a single detail does not end with its essence and content. Each detail is part of a way of life, part of a Torah that carries morality and wisdom, kindness and honesty. And I think that's really what you're saying.
That's great.
So I want to, yeah, exactly. I just wanted to share it because I thought, you know, well, you know, Rav Amital.
And in this case, this little detail, when blown up, becomes a powerful lesson in faith.
Absolutely. The word prazim. And again, I think the reason it resonates with me is, again, because any thinking person should have that question. Like, it's been bothering me always. Like, because it says prazim, so like the cities that are walled in the time of Yehoshua, like what? Like, that's got to mean something, right? If you have that understanding that it's got to mean something, it nags at you. And then when somebody gives an answer that's so inspiring, it reinforces Like, oh, there it is. Right. There's that
And
beautiful
we
Torah
might not
ending.
always find the answer, and we're comfortable maintaining, being devoted to a system where we don't understand every piece of it,
Exactly.
but understanding that it's a lifelong endeavor and it could be a generations long endeavor to
Correct.
find the meaning. We're
But I
patient.
think, yeah. That, but I, exactly, but I think that patience is important as well, because I think a lot of times, instead of getting frustrated and saying, I don't understand this, so therefore I'm going to critique the system, I try to have the attitude of like, there are all these things I didn't understand. And then one day I woke up and this incredible meaning was revealed to me. So maybe I should give a little bit of a like credit to the Torah, which has so far not let me down, and I think that that attitude is also a very, it's helpful. It's helpful when we're approaching, including when we have difficulties. All right, so now let's turn to the third part of this conversation, the third and final part, which is really the part that hooked me in. Because when I read your article, I really felt that the message that you were giving is a message that very much gave me personal chizuk during this time. And so I don't know if you want to talk about it a little bit first, or you want me to describe like how it resonated with me.
Well, you
You
roll
let me
with it. You
know.
started talking about how
Okay.
meaningful it was, so tell us
All
more
right.
about it.
So I'll tell you how meaningful I thought it was and why. Because what here's how I heard your message. The way I heard your message, and again, I'm going to quote from your article, the last paragraph. What you basically said was, when we're in difficult or scary times, right? The call is a call to have courage and a call to have faith. And I'm just going to quote what you, your less your words. The message of the Book of Esther is not that we can never fail, but that we must ultimately succeed. No one specific mission is guaranteed, but the general and ultimate success of the Jewish people remains certain. Faith in God, as learned from the Book of Esther, does not mean certainty in one's own success, but it does mean that whatever efforts one contributes to the betterment of the Jewish people belongs to a general effort whose success is guaranteed. Now, again, I want to give this caveat because I think it's really important. I think there are a lot of people suffering, and I think we're in a time that is so heavy and so fraught. People are suffering for different reasons. People are suffering personal losses. People are suffering fears. People are suffering vicarious pain at losses that they're seeing, and everybody processes things differently. So I really want to make space that what I'm about to describe is a part, first of all, even if I feel it. It's not everything I feel. It's a part I feel, and I can have other parts. I can have parts that are worried or afraid or despondent or angry even at God or questioning God. And I also want to say that our nation is big and also has parts, and not everything will speak to everybody. And I want to have compassion in that sense of like, I think if you don't acknowledge that, I feel like that's not hearing or seeing everybody. And so it's very, very important for me to say that. That being said, I think that this idea, I feel like the Jewish people at this time are thirsting for this idea. And I think that we're seeing it expressed. And again, maybe it's, parts of the nation, but it's a lot of parts of the nation. I feel like there's this thirst for meaning. I do think it's connected, as we said before, to this sense of being part of a national experience. But I think we're seeing all of these, like there's this thirst within the Jewish people to connect to their identity and to connect to faith and Jewish faith as a source of strength in this crisis. And again, this is all anecdotal, right? But like, I'm saying it, giving like all we can say is stand in awe of the hostages who return, and we see things like Agam Burger holding up a sign that says Derech Emunah Bacharti, right? Like, I chose faith, and that's what got me through. Or Keith Siegel saying, I knew nothing. I knew nothing. I was not connected. And then I started, like, I remembered the bracha of Hamotzi, so I started making a Hamotzi on my pizza. And then I heard this bracha of Mizono, so I started saying Mizono. And he comes out and he says, the only thing I want to do, they ask him, what do you want to eat at your first Friday night meal? And I think he's going to say, what is the delicacy that he wants to eat? And he says, all I want is a kippah and a kiddush cup so that we can say Kiddush. Or, and again, these stories are endless. Like the picture of the brother of Sharabi, the Sharabi family. I think Sharon Sharabi is the brother. When he meets his long lost brother, he's puts on a talis. He makes a shechianu, or the latest havdalah. I don't know how many people have seen it, but this havdalah in the hospital with our three of our released hostages, and the grandfather of one of them, A, making a shechianu, and then B, making a havdalah. And it's, the stories are endless. And again, I don't want to take away. I'm sure there are many people who have lost their faith. I'm sure. I'm not speaking, and I'm not critiquing that. But we just seem to encounter over and over and over. And one of the silliest examples, and I'm going to bring it in, even though, like, you know, this might enrage some of our viewers. But it's so shocking to me that this song, this Odio Tertov, Odio Tertov, there's a song. The words are, God loves me and everything's going to be great, right? And so many philosophers are like going out of their minds because they're like, I'm not sure that that's a Jewish, and we can, that's, you know, I don't really have time for that conversation, but I'll refer people to Mark's article here about the nature of faith and the footnote about how faith works. And you know, let's leave that aside because I don't think that that's relevant. I think that the reason people are singing those words, I actually, again, I'm going to just read a bit of what I wrote about this conversation when there was like a this philosophical discussion. Is it okay? Is it permissible? You know, it was written by a Rav named Rav Arush who writes books about faith. And okay, so I wouldn't have to believe in everything Rav Arush says, but what I wrote was, this song is resonating with people, not because they are simplistic or simple-minded. It is because they want to plug into hope and spiritual resilience. They also want to believe that despite all the hardships they encounter and see all around them, they want to connect to the belief that God ultimately loves them. And I would kind of formulate that last sentence as, they want to connect to the belief that something is happening with the Jewish people, with the Jewish nation, and that our trajectory, ultimately, as you said, we can't predict setbacks, but all we can do is sort of like believe that in the big picture, like, again, I don't know what that's going to look like, how down the downs are going to be, but that as Mordechai could say it in Shushan, right? I think we could have the bravery to say it as a prayer. Please, God, be with us here in our national endeavor. And there are going to be downs, but please, please let there be more ups. And we want to use that as a source of courage so that we can keep trying, so that we don't have to give up on our moments of courage, so that we can partner with you, God, in trying to make it better. And so that when we have choices to make, like the Meraglet and like Esther, we're going to make those good choices, and we're prayerful to you. We don't know whether our individual choices, as you said, are going to succeed, but we're prayerful that if at least we're all trying, somehow some of those will lead us into a positive place. And I think the country is thirsting for that feeling. And again, I don't want to minimize parts that aren't, but there's a big piece that is, and I find it inspiring. I find Am Yisrael inspiring. I find the Jewish people inspiring. I find all these examples. I, as a person who's not so brave naturally, when I see this courage, it's just, to me, just absolutely awe-inspiring. That's my feeling.
It's an extraordinary thing that unfortunately during this war, I imagine most people know someone who lost someone,
absolutely,
or have some very, very, very small degree of separation from someone who lost someone. And while we are suffering losses and tragedies, we still have people rushing into the fight with the sense that this is what I have to do. People injured coming home and then saying, once I'm healed, I have to get back in. And it is this a long-term telescopic view that I am part of something that I know will succeed, even though there are setbacks and people don't necessarily know what's going to happen in their specific situation. They know that they're on a winning team, and they also know that in fighting with that winning team, they're partnering with the Jewish people, but also with God and God's plan. And there's an extraordinary transformation from fear to courage, not because I know what's going to happen to me, but because I know that I am with a program whose program director is HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, who I know has an ultimate plan. And the Chazon Ish talks about this in his book, Emunah Bitachon, that the proper meaning of bitachon, trust in God, is not to trust that the outcome that I want will occur if I simply have enough faith and trust in God. I don't know if the outcome that I want will occur, but the trust that I have in God is that he knows what he's doing and that he doesn't let things happen just because, and that in whatever I'm going through, Yirtzeh Hashem, it should be good, but whether it's good or Chas v'Chalila, it's bad, that it is all under the watch of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and happens for a reason and is a progress towards something greater. When I was in Yeshiva, Yeshivat HaRetzion, Rav Menachem Liebtag gave a very good analogy to this. He drew on the board a wave, like a sine wave, and said life has ups and downs, hills and crests. And he said, but if you take that line and you tilt it so that its trajectory is now going up, so that means that even if you're going to go down, but the crest at one point on the line is actually going to be higher than the high points at an earlier part in the line, because the trajectory keeps going up. And to keep that long-term view in mind is the view, as I mentioned earlier, of Hashgacha Klalit. And we also pray for and hope for Hashgacha Pratit. But to keep that long-term view in mind can be very encouraging and give people a sense of belonging, maybe a sense of comfort, even while undergoing very difficult situations.
I think that's a good place to end. I think that, I think that says it all. I want to thank you for this conversation, which again, your article inspired me, your words inspire me. Again, that's not to minimize the difficulties, but I think that's the message. It's in the face of the difficulties, the challenge of the ongoing work of having that courage and that dynamic experience of moving towards that place of courage and faith. So thank you very, very, very much for this conversation. And Yashikov, it's really wonderful article.
Thank you so much, Molly. Thank you for having me. We all pray for Besorot Tovot, Ge'ula Shleima, and it was really good talking to you. Thank you.
Thanks.